Here we are with another edition of Blunt Business on CannabisRadio.com. My next guest represents a Denver-based premier cannabis and tech venture capital and consulting firm that provides guidance, capital strategy, and corporate governance to companies in emerging markets. I'm joined with the Chief Investment Officer of Clientele Capital. Let me spell that out for you. C-L-I-I-N-T-E-L Capital. And I'm here with Rick Battenberg. Rick, thanks for being on with us.
Hey, thank you so much for having me. That is the best introduction I think I've ever had, actually. So thank you so much.
Keep it smooth. Keep it quick. Because we know our podcast listeners out there. I had a quote for an article coming up. And they asked, you know, what's the most important thing about the intro for a podcast? I said, you know what? Your listeners have short attention span. You better let them know who they're listening to and what they're talking about the first 30 seconds. If you don't, you might lose that. You might lose the retention.
Hey, it's all about you clearly know what you're doing. I've seen your listeners. So
it's about audience retention.
Sure. Hopefully I add some value for you.
So you're a former, and I should have put you on, I could almost put you on Plant Profits because they like the profiles and leadership. You're a former financial advisor and private equity specialist at Merrill Lynch. You've assisted cannabis startup companies with capital strategy, corporate governing, investor relations, and mentoring C-level executives through growth and funding processes as Clientele's CIO. So I want to know from you about the community, the commonalities, and the contrast between the mainstream sector you worked at with Merrill Lynch and mainstream financing with what you encounter regularly in the cannabis side of venture capital consulting.
Sure. You know, my work at Merrill Lynch, I did a lot of the syndicate on new issues and IPOs. So I looked at a lot of deals, companies that were funding, right? So they were funding new capital, raising new capital for whatever venture they might have. And these were generally established companies. But looking at the style, format, and kind of the boilerplate information that was provided to me so that I could then talk to my retail clients about, hey, this is what this company is doing. And I really got a very clear understanding on what it takes to look and feel and taste like a company that can be funded, you know, taken public, whatever it might be. And so from the translation perspective, understanding that when I left Merrill Lynch, it was really because I saw an opportunity in cannabis because there was a capital inefficiency, because there was a lack of investors that were allowed to invest into cannabis. So by creating a venture fund, we became the first qualified institutional fund in the country to hold a license inside of a venture fund. And that structure is really what allowed me to allocate capital across the supply chain to establish a diligence baseline. So grow, extraction, dispensary, packaging, hardware, compliance, training, licensing, didn't matter. And the point of that was to establish a diligence baseline because nobody really knew what a good cannabis company was supposed to do. But my work at Merrill, looking at what these more established companies do when they're raising money, made me aware of what it was going to take for a cannabis company to move to the next level. Like, this is what you need to look like, regardless of what industry you're in. This is what it takes. This is the diligence level at the highest level that is expected if you want to raise money from institutional or high net worth people or whoever it might be.
And I'm going to imagine it's always been interesting with the cannabis industry. Since we started the network in 2015, the reliance upon venture capital, when it's so tough. I mean, there's just no institutional funding because the regulations aren't there. And you're working through. And the one thing I always notice, and I will talk about this a little bit later, is there's always the high risk involved, but the rewards are so deep if done correct. If you lock in with the right company.
Absolutely. So you're absolutely correct that the capital markets in general, right? I think of them as a cake, right? And so in this stack of cake, this tiered cake, as you move down, the pool gets bigger, right? So at the very bottom, right, you've got the public markets, right? Everybody can invest, right? Mm-hmm. And at the tippy top, you've got angel investors, right? And then you've got everything in between. And so what's been going on is the cake has been started to being eaten by the cannabis industry, right? And the highest risk tolerance, the angel investors, and then you've got venture capital, then you've got private equity, then you've got, you know, institutional capital, then you've got, big funds, and then you've got the public markets, right? And because the risk is so much higher, right, the cake might fall over, the risk is so much higher at the tippy top, that capital is super expensive for those companies. And so a lot of unsophisticated cannabis companies, especially in their early stages, not only did they not have a lot of people to go to for capital, but the people that they were asking for capital for were highly sophisticated and frankly taking advantage of these companies because they could. So a lot of good cannabis companies gave up so much equity early that they've hamstrung themselves at this point that they can't even move forward because that they've given away so much equity. And they've given away so much, you know, they've got bad debt instruments because the debt markets and the equity markets were so competitive, or sort of non-competitive, you know, during the evolution of cannabis, which created these really inefficient capital structures for a lot of these private cannabis companies that has created an opportunity right now, in my opinion.
And I think about the also that there have been companies, and, you know, I'll talk to some friends of mine in the space, and I have one friend of mine, good friend of mine, that has always been very much involved in trying to get funding for his own projects. He runs a tracking software. And I'll tell you, it's funny how many different companies, he's like, how is it these other companies get this kind of spend and they just blow it away? They just let it go and there's nothing that can be done about it. For me, it's like, you know, I think of Robert Kiyosaki's book, Rich Dad, Poor Dad, or the Investor's Quotient, I think it is again.
That book's sitting right behind me right now, actually.
There you go. You know what? Because I was trying to learn a lot about stock market right at the start of pandemic. That was like my hobby to pick up right then and there. Not so much now because, you know, we have inflation and just this very volatile market. We're bear market now. Anybody saying it else otherwise, I don't believe it. But to make sure that one of these cannabis companies becomes bait for a qualified investor, like to be able to reach those high end, because, you know, of course you're going to have those investors that, you know, that are, you could try to get some celebrity jump in on it or somebody else that doesn't know what's going on financially.
I have some strong opinions about that too. So,
well, I would love to hear them.
Sure. So, you know, at the consumer level, people really don't care about what celebrities endorsing a product at all. And we see this.
What I'm saying is because just they don't care. The other thing is that the companies that are trying to get the investment money, if they can get them to be suckered into giving the money up, and it's a lost cause. I mean, how many celebrities do we know that have gone broke on bad deals?
Absolutely. Oh my gosh. I've seen thousands of deals, and I can't tell you how many of them had nothing to do with the quality of the company's product. And that's really the tragic part. And there's two components to that are really the biggest key, right? So the application 280E makes it extraordinarily difficult for a private cannabis company to be profitable. Almost impossible, frankly. And the unfair application of that is a serious problem that has stifled the development of the cannabis industry in general. The second component is because of the lack of sophistication of many of the Gen 1 operators, Gen 2 operators in making these deals with these very sophisticated, high risk tolerant venture capital and high net worth people, they've put themselves in a really tough position from a capital stack perspective to move forward any further, right? So you've got an environment where you can't write your labor, your insurance, or your rent against your top line revenue. So you're raising your effective tax rate. I've seen deals where their effective tax rate is north of 50%, which makes it extraordinarily difficult to become a profitable company, right? So these sort of macro regulatory issues have really hindered the manifest destiny of the brands, if you will. So, you know, whenever I'm evaluating companies, we look at different metrics other than necessarily just how much money did you make? You know, top line revenue and amount of distribution. How many consumers know who you are is a better metric for whether or not your brand or product is going to be valuable in 10 years than how much net revenue you're producing. So that evaluation has given us a unique insight into kind of who is being successful in the cannabis industry and who is establishing that emotional relationship with the consumer.
Yeah. And, you know, I don't know if the Safe Banking Act, if when that ever gets to be something that will finally get in front of the Senate, you know, after it goes to the House, it goes to Rules Committee, gets passed, and then we get to the Senate, and of course, everything just dies in the Senate. But that would be ultimately the way to neutralize that Section 280E of the tax code. I mean, hopefully that is something that's embedded in that bill someday if we get that to kind of help.
Well, I'll tell you the same thing my father's been telling me since I was a kid is hope is not a strategy. It's not for sure that 280E would go away with the safe banking. There's a variety of ways that 280E could go away. Descheduling, rescheduling, legalization, 280E could do it. But because there's so much chaos in Washington, it's very hard to go, okay, well, here's when it's going to happen. Here's what's going to happen. So if you're a cannabis operator, making a plan based off of a regulatory shift is a really difficult thing to do. And it's also a difficult thing to sell it to an investor, right? Because it's like, well, they have no control of it, right? And if your business plan is predicated on only being profitable when you get 280E removed, well, you got to survive until then, right? So how do you evaluate that company? But in my opinion, as a venture capitalist, that creates an asymmetrical risk to return profile, meaning I know I'm going to get a bump. It's not if, it's when, right? I know it's coming, right? So how you need to use different metrics to do the diligence on the type of companies that we look at taking positions in.
And when you think back about people that you still know in the circles in finance and the financial sector and investing when you worked at Merrill Lynch and the people you met around those other institutions, I always have Steve D'Angelo. I always remember him talking to Richard Zwicky on the Green Peak in the episode there on our network. And I just remember him talking about, there are investors in Silicon Valley. And I just think also there are a lot of investors, potential investors. They're just waiting in the wings. They're just fence sitting right now, waiting for something from cannabis to open up regulatory wise, and they're going to jump on it. Do you think that's what's happening now? Are they just basically just waiting for something to come up and they're going to just jump in?
Well, I think that you're painting with a real broad brush there. So let me be more specific.
Oh, please.
Okay. There's always investors waiting in the wings for something to happen, right? And you're seeing that the reactionary market of the retail market, when we see some sort of a legislation passed that doesn't mean anything, right? And you see the reaction of the stock. Now, there's always investors waiting in the wings, right? There, and I can tell you that I know way more financial people than I do from my work in the venture capital space in the last 8 years than I did in the 3 years I worked at Merrill Lynch. At Merrill Lynch, my relationship was largely with my retail clients, and I was sitting there reading a lot, right? Being out there and playing the game, meeting all the investment banks, working with Canaccord, I've met with every C-suite, a publicly traded companies, it's a small world as you start to get bigger and bigger. And frankly, the big banks is really the only powerful lobby in DC that has anything to gain from federal legalization, because they've been watching Canaccord Genuity make all kinds of money, raising money for cannabis companies that were buying US operators, right? And they're raising money at like 182 times forward earnings in November of 2018. So I can tell you that money is absolutely poised and ready and wants this, right? That's really the only big lobby in DC that has anything to gain from what's called federal legalization, deschedulization, safe banking. Because the feds are already picking up a bunch of tax revenue from cannabis, they're not really incentivized to federally legalize cannabis. They don't really make any extra money. So when we talk about this this push, it's really good to understand that the feds don't care. They're already making the money, right? Like, legalize and tax it. Oh, they did. They already did. And you know what? They let the states handle it. And that's part of the other reason I don't think we're going to see interstate trade commerce is because guess what? When two state citizens sue each other of two different states, it automatically becomes a federal matter, which means the feds would have to oversee it. Mm-hmm. And we don't have any infrastructure or precedents to oversee cannabis cases, right? So they want the states to deal with it. It's going to stay a state's right. And, having grew up here in Colorado, and I know some of our politicians here, state politicians, and there's nothing that unites Democrats and Republicans quite like hating DC. They basically just stay out of our shit. We don't want you here. We don't need you to tell us how to run our state. So there's not a lot of pressure from the big money in DC for federal legalization. And that's just the truth. The only pressure is coming from the banks who stand to benefit from doing the investment banking for the cannabis industry to allow more institutional capital come into these yeah. spaces.
We actually had Governor Polis from Colorado on our NCAA's Cannabis Industry Voice talking about that kind of struggle right there with DC and having to get letters sent up there and trying to get some responses back. And yeah,
I've spent some time with Mr. Polis.
So and you know what? I'll tell you, Rick, you talk about how big banks. Okay. I was just looking up right now on opensecrets.org, $57 million spent on lobbying by the commercial banks in 2021. Well, you know, who's got a little bit more than that? Big Pharma, $250 million.
You know, Big Pharma's got a big, big
war chest. Jesus.
They absolutely do. And you got to remember that Big Pharma is completely predicated on the infrastructure of our medical system. So, their ability to spend $100 million developing a drug, right? And then having it patented, right? And then having a finite amount of time to charge an obnoxious amount of money for it mm-hmm. is how that business model works. And when you've got a plant, right, that largely can replace some of the pharmaceuticals, that's a big threat to that industry yeah. and to a lot of very smart and to a lot of very highly invested people that have a lot to lose. So, yeah. you know, what's going on right now and why you're seeing this constipation in DC with the federal legalization is because there's a lot of posturing going on. You know, things change when rich white guys in ties make money. And that's the truth, right, in Washington. And if they're not positioned correctly, shit ain't going to change.
That's
so
true.
Right now, you're seeing a lot of posturing going on by big pharma, big ag, big food, and then you've got alcohol, tobacco. You've got everybody's looking at cannabis, trying to understand where they want to be in that supply chain. Where do they want to be when it as it pertains to touching the consumer? But if you're already a big company mm-hmm. and you're already doing deals multi-state, you really can't touch cannabis yet, right? So they don't want to see it until they feel like they're in a position to take advantage of it, which is why you're not seeing it just jam through, because the consent, the votes are in, right? Worldwide, definitely in the United States, this is a good thing, right? We've got hard data out of Colorado, which in my opinion is the most developed and mature cannabis market in the world, representing real true Keynesian economics and consumer-driven price theory.
Yeah.
It's good. We know it's good for the people. We know it's good. We all the data points to this is a good thing for the people, for the businesses, for the tax structure, for the schools, for the impact on our youth, for the impact on people that are dealing with a chronic medical crisis. It's unequivocal, right? The only reason that it hasn't moved forward, only reason is because what's happening in Washington is that the people who have the biggest lobbies are not positioned to take advantage of the burgeoning cannabis industry yet.
It's not enough they already have the money in there. It's about who's getting it and who's getting it to the right people to do some, make some moves. Yeah.
Got it. You got it.
So there's a lot more to talk about. We got to go to a break, but when we come back, I want to go ahead and ask you, though you were actually interviewed, about how 2022 will be a year of consolidation and competition for cannabis. And it's been about 4 months since you made some comments to Forbes magazine. We're going to talk about that after a short break. I'm here with the Chief Investment Officer of Clientele Capital, Rick Battenberg. And the website is clientelecapital.com, C-L-I-I-N-T-E-L capital.com. Check a look at the website as we go to break.
Rolling into some sponsors, but we'll be right back with more Blunt Business.
Welcome back to Blunt Business. I'm here with Rick Battenberg, Chief Investment Officer at Clientele Capital. Now, you were interviewed by Forbes magazine in December. Let's talk about the next year, 2022, will be the year of consolidation and competition for cannabis. You said this, quote, that's a long quote, by the way, regulations, marketing, and scale. Cannabis in its current regulatory environment is not adaptable or scalable. The market is experiencing arrested development due to crippling tax regulations, a lack of institutional banking, and the commoditization of the plant, leaving operators with little to no margin for revenue and further incentivizing the consolidation of the industry. The MSO expansion, we talked about on the show extensively. Quote, creating an emotional connection with consumers will continue to be key to success in cannabis, much like any industry. But in cannabis, brands must also create a strong connection with bud tenders who are highly influential in shaping consumers' buying preferences. You can spend all the money you want on marketing, but if the bud tender suggests a different product, then you can't win. I love that. By consolidating and growing, companies enhance their ability to execute comprehensive multi-pronged marketing strategies that engage consumers and budtenders at all levels. Surviving this year is possible by creating a consistent product, building an authentic brand, and getting as much shelf space in as many dispensaries in as many states as possible. How's that held up in the last 4 months that you said that?
I got to give credit to my marketing team there as well for editing my words, because I couldn't have said it better myself. that's exactly what's going on. And I stand by those comments, and I have for a long time. And that's really because I believe to navigate the cannabis market, you really have to take a macroeconomic analysis of what's happening now and what's going to happen in 10 years and 20 years. And where in the supply chain do you want to be? Do you really want to be the farmer growing the grain for the Grey Goose? Or do you want to be own the liquor store that only has geographic loyalty? Or do you want to own Grey Goose, right? And in an environment where you've got an organic plant, that even genetically identical plants grown under different conditions will produce different relative weight to volumes of minor and major cannabinoids and terpene profiles, I don't care what celebrity is endorsing your brand, and I don't care how shiny your package is. If right. you haven't delivered the same product in two different states, you don't have a brand, okay? So it's really our thesis, our venture fund thesis is really about delivering consistent quality product to consumers. And that's the key, right? A Coca-Cola is a Coca-Cola is a Coca-Cola, right? No matter where you are, right? Because the same is objective. The best is subjective, right? The Clear, which is one of our premier portfolio companies, I could make an argument they're the best, but it doesn't matter, right? The point is, it really doesn't matter, right? It's won all kinds of High Times Cup, won all kinds of stuff. But that doesn't matter. What matters is that when you buy a Clear pen in Boston or LA or Vegas or Denver or Detroit, it's the same. It's exactly the same.
It's like McDonald's. Right? Consistent, exactly. Quality product. Exactly.
You got it. You got it exactly. And so I stand by that. And I think that's because as we get ubiquitous legalization, right? And I believe that, it's coming, right? And I feel like it's that.
Not if, but when, right?
I feel like it's that when at episode of, or Holy Grail, when the guy's running at the castle and he keeps running at the castle and he never quite get there.
Right.
That's how cannabis feels to me.
But now, we see the MSO operators. They're all expanding. They're growing themselves up. They're buying much more facilities. They're just expanding their sites. They're preparing for what eventually will be legalization. That's what they're going to do. And I feel like it's in the media. I'm a big, critic of the media in general, in terms of all, because of the digital disruption that goes on with the media. And before that, it's like, okay, let's deregulate. When deregulation came into play, all these media companies started gobbling each other to create monopolies. We're getting to that point again here. We're getting monopolies already set up before we even get to legalization.
You got it exactly. And so there's some other things at play here that are important to understand about why that happened. All of the big cannabis companies right now, today, and I say big, I mean basically big market cap companies that are Canadian traded, okay? Whether they were SPACs or not, they were SPACs, okay? Because what they were doing is raising money at extremely high valuations based off of extremely high multiples. And then they were going in and buying uncorrelated assets to try to get their revenue to catch up to their valuations. But the problem with doing that is that when you're going out and you're buying a bunch of $20 an hour employees, okay, you are no longer buying culture, right? You're not buying scale, you're buying the revenue, right? And so when you look at companies like Verano, right, missing earnings, not missing how much, like they couldn't get their earnings together, right? When you look at companies that have consolidated all of these different assets, they haven't grown up, right? They've just bought different assets because they're being run by Canadian bankers. And that creates a very unstable ecosystem, okay, that doesn't have any relationship with the consumer. All they're trying to do is basically own supply chain, which doesn't establish any kind of real relationship with the consumer, nor does it deliver quality product. So yes, there are, let's call them monopolies being created where they're owning large grows. But what I would submit to you is that it's not really a monopoly until somebody owns the consumer, okay? And that's simply because when you're producing all these products in different states, even though the brand says the same, it says whatever, Cresco, Tilray, whatever it says on it, if you haven't produced the same product consistently, right? Then you haven't really created a monopoly. All you've created is the supply chain, which means that as you get ubiquitous legalization and further competition, it just creates margin compression, right? We watch that in Oregon specifically, right? So every market is its own little test of its own little ecosystem based off of how many licenses were issued, how many medical, what was the regulatory environment? Is it medical? Is it rec? How many med patients are there? How many dispensaries are there? Every little ecosystem is its own little test on what it's really going to look like in 20 years. And I think Colorado has done the best job, now not perfect, but done the best job of allowing the cannabis company to grow with real consumer driven market theory.
And not trying to suffocate them with a tax rate that's just over the roof.
Absolutely. Well, I mean, the feds did that for us, so they don't, you know, no reason to put two pillows on grandma.
When you see the craft cannabis companies in California struggling with the tax revenue, needing for an increase because, well, $1 billion, that's not enough in the tax revenue for California, for the coffers. Governor Newsom wants more. Then you have the issues in New Jersey with unionization.
Got it.
Where they just opened that up. It's preposterous
that cannabis is just not taxed like a normal business, right? Yeah. That's really all I would ask for as somebody who holds a lot of private cannabis assets is treat us like a normal business. Period. That's it. That's all we are asking for.
Well, that's just the cream of the crop. Then there's the issue I was just mentioning. The cannabis wing of the International Union of Journeymen of Allied Trades. Now they got in help with some bud tenders and got 22 employees into a cannabis dispensary into a 3-year agreement for unionization. Mm-hmm. And we know that's going to spread across the board. Hey, to the group at Local 420 CED. In New Jersey, good for them. Good on them to get the wage increases and benefits. Yep, the other thing that wasn't talked about either, which I'm going to keep hampering here on this program because I got it through the grassroots marketing series, our sister series, where we talked to Eben Sumner of the Maine Growers Alliance and how Maine was trying to go ahead and institute where Metric was going to be the only tracking service that was going to be allowed.
Right.
And some companies were not going to be able to afford it because it was just too much. Those kind of things going along here, these are issues that are not being looked at right now. And when you want companies to also look as well, they need to keep their bottom line as best as possible. But this right here, you're seeing, the big boys taking their spot even before we get to legalization. The big companies are already holding their spots. They're the pillars now. Where's the room for the little guy?
You know what? And that is more of a capital markets issue than it is a cannabis market issue, if I'm being honest with you. So that's not unique to cannabis, frankly. When you really are looking at cannabis, does it hurt cannabis, the little guy, as you say, the little guy, for there to not be federal legalization? And what I would say to you is that the only reason that I was even able to start a venture capital firm and make it this far was because there was not federal legalization. If I would have been in Canada, I wouldn't have made it because I've been able to scale up as we've gotten more and more legalization. Okay. So what I would submit to you is that if we get the SAFE banking or if we get federal legalization, it actually is going to make it almost impossible for the little guy to have an opportunity. That's the truth.
So, and that's why, I was worrying about it too. And I saw all these C-level executives coming in. Listen, you're giving legitimacy to the space, but I know what you're going to do soon enough. That's the writing's on the wall, which is why I'm saying, and I will say it over and over. I talked to every lobbying organization, United States Cannabis Council, CPAIR, NCIA, I talked to them all. Listen, you need, diversity, equity, inclusion, fine. Social equity, sure. Everybody needs a seat at the table before this comes to pass. That has to happen. If there's a way to do it, all these companies pay attention to this program. Remember, you need to have a seat at the table. So you need to be spoken, need to be heard for, and you don't want to be stepped on.
Yep. And it's going to be a tough row to hoe. Let me tell you.
Yeah, it is. Now, I'll tell you this, let's go and move along into some legal issues when it comes to mergers and acquisitions. This was a really great story. And actually, we talked to, one of the companies is part of this that we've had on the program. So legal experts brought this up, and I saw this about mergers and acquisitions, M&A contracts published in the National Law Review. In the last year, parties have announced cannabis M&A deals in the hundreds of millions and even billion-dollar ranges. You've seen that. I'm sure you might have been a part of those yourselves. It's not hard to see, however, how recent decisions refusing to enforce cannabis-related contracts could negatively impact M&A activity in the industry. Indeed, it is hard to think of a greater deterrent to consolidation than the inability to actually enforce the party's carefully crafted deal. So the contracts might not even hold water. So here's one case they talk about, that there's a way to get out of this mess through a common commercial term, arbitration. So in the case of Williams versus Ease Solutions, the cannabis delivery service based out of California, we talked about on the program, the U.S. District Court for the Northern District of California rejected an illegality challenge to a contract asserted by a California resident who downloaded a cannabis mobile application created by Ease Solutions. The district court's reasoning was elegant in its simplicity. The party's contract expressly provided for the arbitration of the party's disputes, and under the FAA, Federal Arbitration Act, and binding Supreme Court precedent, any issues of illegality were to be determined by the arbitrators at the federal courts. What do you think about this workaround there, Rick?
I think it's the only option that the federal court had. Right? Because like I mentioned earlier in the podcast, if soon as two state citizens sue each other.
Lowe's knows that free makes everything better. That's why our rewards members get free standard shipping on the things they need and want, starting at Silver Key status every day. Savings for rewards members add up fast. So why wait? Join for free today. Lowe's, we help. You save. Not available in Alaska and Hawaii. Exclusions and more terms apply. Loyalty program subject to terms and conditions. Details at lowes.com/shipping terms. Subject to change.
Each other, it becomes a federal matter. And because we are not currently have any precedence to oversee federal matters in the terms of cannabis, the only option is arbitration. So the answer is simple, right? It's not that it's an eloquent solution. It's the only solution.
Yep. Also, they go on to say that, quote, unless and until Congress amends the Controlled Substances Act 10 or otherwise resolves the existing and widening conflict between federal law and state laws on cannabis, the illegality defense will loom over any attempt to enforce a cannabis-related contract, no matter how big or small.
Absolutely.
They also say cannabis investors, businesses, and those who do business with them would be wise to take a lesson from the case law above and opt for arbitration or litigation in their commercial cannabis contracts. Now, are there any remedies you think besides this that will alleviate? What's the best course of action if companies do encounter this issue? You know, if arbitration is not something they can do, it's not embedded into the contract, you know, if it's going to be, the contract's going to be compromised.
You're screwed. I mean, as far as your options, I mean, I'm going to give it to you cards on the table, which is this is a systemic problem, right? This is one symptom of the larger issue, which is the inefficiency of the regulations from a federal to a state component, right? And really, it just comes down to the feds need to make it so that the states have control of their own destiny, right? So that the states can interact and do business themselves, allow the federal banks to do business with them. This is part of the reason that there's a lot of cannabis companies in trouble, is that they didn't have the foresight to put these very technical things into the type of deals they were doing. And really, through no fault of their own, in any other business, these are very commonplace mistakes that new operators would have made. But to be successful in cannabis has so little to do with cannabis and so much more to do with navigating a very difficult changing regulatory environment, that the most successful cannabis companies are, you know, they're attorneys by attrition, because they've had to create these intricate structures to navigate such a difficult climate. And that is an unfortunate truth of the cannabis industry, frankly. Yeah. You know, there's great products that I've seen that deserved a better fate, but because of their capital position, weren't able to continue. And it's really tragic, because they were providing value to consumers, which at the end of the day, the only goal is to add value to people's lives, period, yeah. Right? At the end of the day, somebody's using this product. Are you adding value to that consumer's life? And everything else we do is just compliance. Everything else we do is just right. To be able to provide that value. And being able to navigate that is expensive, difficult, complicated,
and it's a cost that has to be burned into your bottom line. It has to be something you have to. It's imperative.
You
basically have to have an apartment just for that within your doing, or unless you're going to be like that one company. What's the one I always talk about that had to burn $12 million worth of product? Was it? Oh, I forgot the name of it. I got to go look for it again in British Columbia. I will never forget. But it's those kind of things. Say again? It is. Oh, totally. Totally. I'll look it up over the break. In the meantime, we got to go take another commercial break. I'm here again with Rick Battenberg, Chief Investment Officer at Clientele Capital. Again, the website is Clientele, CLIINTEL Capital.com. We're back after a short break.
Rolling into some sponsors, but we'll be right back with more Blunt Business.
Welcome back to Blunt Business. I'm here with Rick Battenberg, the Chief Investment Officer at Clientele Capital. During the break, I had to go and look up because I mentioned, and again, this is where you need to worry about compliance, folks. By the way, not just now, but we have two examples. Number one was CanTrust. I have said this many times. October 14, 2019, what a black day for that company. Had to destroy $12 million worth of plants, $65 million worth of product, I think it was. And then another one just recently, it wasn't too long ago, in Canada, that they had to go and destroy 6 million packages of dried cannabis extraction edibles, 20% of their entire product.
Whoa.
That's a lot of... So keep that in mind.
We like to joke. We're not in the cannabis business. We're in the compliance business.
And I'm telling you, when you brought up compliance, you said how important it was. I'm just putting those two examples. That's just Canada. Wait till we get it here. We're going to hear stories like this unless all of you, and we're saying it out of love, we're saying out of respect for the industry. You need to keep an eye on this stuff. That's why you listen to this program, because you see I'm on this soapbox every week, thumping this over and over like a pulpit. I need to make this clear to all of you. Keep that in mind. And that's my opinion. That's not of the guests or, you know, anybody else here on the program. Now,
You got my vote. Don't worry.
I appreciate it. All right. One more thing I got to ask about. And we did talk about investors and the investors that are out there. PitchBook recently wrote, South by Southwest recently happened. Long been a beacon of the future that will be funded by venture capital. The event secured its place as a vital part of the venture capital ecosystem and its ever optimistic quest to create the future of everything. And this year was no exception. They had experts delving into some of Silicon Valley's biggest passion projects, everything from crypto and climate science to the metaverse and psychedelics. We're starting to see now in our space, psychedelics are starting to come into a parallel where companies are looking to go ahead and add that into their portfolio or looking to create parallel companies. What do you think about incorporating that second to the portfolio of companies that you might be consulting or that others are looking into?
So interestingly enough, so, you know, there's a lot of people that assume I know a lot about psychedelics because I've my work in the cannabis industry. So, you know, I was forced to do some diligence and macroeconomic analysis of the psychedelic industry myself, just by nature of the fact that I was being asked so much. And frankly, as it pertains to cannabis specifically, I feel like they're completely incongruent. And part of that is just because the macroeconomics of how psilocybin psilocybin specifically, psychedelics obviously can involve ketamine and other psychedelics.
Sure.
However, for about $250,000, you can produce 80 into a shipping container. You can produce 80 pounds of dry psilocybin a month, okay, for very, very cheap. And the economics of that break down very quickly based off of how much psilocybin people can consume. So I went to some of my friends who consume the most psilocybin, and I'm like, how much are you using? And then I reverse engineer the numbers and they break down really fast. There's not a lot of margin there just based on how cheap you can produce it. So the psilocybin industry, the psychedelics industry is really going to have to take a more pharma-like route because they're going to have to charge more for the product itself based on how cheaply they can produce it and how much people can consume. So I don't believe that they are in parallel to cannabis in general.
Okay.
Not saying it's a bad business. And frankly, I think it's a fantastic thing for the mental well-being of the nation. But from a business perspective, it's not, psychedelics is not something that I think, you know, I've looked at, and it's not something that I'm.
You don't want to operate under the same name.
No, I just don't think that. I think it's going to take a pharma route. I don't think that it's going to grow up like cannabis at all.
Okay.
There may be recreational distribution, but I think that it's going to be very difficult to make money at it. If there is recreational distribution of psychedelics. So that does not interest me as a venture capitalist to look at that space, just because the very, and you know what, I've been proven wrong before. So, you know, it maybe something changed, but my very, you know, hands-on and dive into the macroeconomic analysis of psilocybin, I immediately was like, oh, this has got some big problems.
Well, I bring that up as well, because I don't, next week, as I record the program, we're recording it just before 420, Benzinga is going to have their Cannabis Capital Conference.
I'll be there.
And they're going to have the psychedelic wing. They're going to have speakers. You're going to have companies that are already embedded into that right now. So the investors are going to be visiting that show. They're going to get exposed to it probably the first time, because just really, this is the year that psychedelics has been brought into the conversation. And for us as Cannabis Radio, I mean, I totally respect where you're coming from with what you said, but sure. I think it's something where you at least have the little oversight. You got to at least observe what's going on at the
least. Absolutely. Absolutely. And I've already got several one-on-one meetings with some companies that have asked to meet with me that are in the psychedelic space. Because again, I believe that, you know, I'm always, I have a policy that drives my right-hand Monica Pino crazy. You know, I always take the meeting. And that's because you don't always know everything. And there's nobody that can teach you faster than somebody who's trying to prove to you that they have a competitive advantage in a market that I don't understand. So they're usually the fastest way for me to understand the macroeconomic market. So I love hearing from entrepreneurs that are passionate about bringing something to market and they feel like they have an advantage. So you know, to first contextualize that advantage, they need to contextualize the market for me. So I'm excited to hear from some of those psychedelic companies. So, you know, prove me wrong. But right now I don't see a advantage unless I was a pharma company. And if I was a pharma company, I'd be looking real close at psychedelics, because they're, you know,
it's starting to gain momentum. And I think right now that industry at the moment
absolutely is
about 5 to 7 years behind what cannabis is right now.
Right. Be wary when everybody is super excited. You're going to be very wary, right? That's when you see these gigantic cannabis SPACs that raised a bunch of money and now can't find a qualifying deal, right? Raising money on excitement is very different than raising money on fundamentals. It's very different. And right now, psychedelics is all just excitement.
That kind of goes back to my point earlier on when we talked about who are the ones that are getting the deals and how quickly they're being squandered, because it's based on excitement and hype.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And right now, all of the deals getting done in psychedelics are based on in hype. Now, that's not to say that it might develop, it might change. There may be, you know,
some good research out there, though. We're getting, again, not in America, not but in Imperial College in London, they're putting a lot of good stuff.
Yeah, again, please don't misunderstand.
Well, no.
I think it needs to come to the world, and I hope it does. I just, from a very like sterile venture perspective, I don't see an entry point that is attractive that I could go back to my investors and go, hey, we can take a strategic position and get a 10X on this.
No. And I agree with you. Listen, it's got to take a lot more going on for the folks of a clientele capital to say, you know what? Okay, let's look into this more. Let's actually be seriously talking about this. It's going to take time. It's 5 to 7 years, I think, behind where cannabis is now. Before we get to, I mean, listen, Oregon's the one state that actually has legalization now for it. And there's other, you know, and those are the places where you could have some shape or form of psychedelics that are being used as treatment right now. We're seeing some benefits, but I guess the idea is also is because we're seeing some similar benefits, the same kind of entourage effect that cannabis has that we're seeing from psychedelics. But absolutely, the research isn't there yet.
There's so much benefit to it. Don't get me twisted.
Correct.
There's so much benefit to it. The contention I have is that the way that it's going to be developed is going to take a more pharma route, which means that it's going to take $100 million to bring something to market. Whereas cannabis, for $2 million, you could get to market.
Yep.
Those are way different business models. Way different business models. And I think that's going to have to take that route just based off of the analysis that I've done so far. But you know, I'm like I said, I'm taking meetings with some psychedelic companies, really just so I can learn more, because you know, diversity of skill set and information is the key to understanding the macroeconomic markets of cannabis or whatever you're evaluating, is getting information and talking to experts.
That's why you say, I'll take the meeting.
That's right. Always take
again, here with Rick Battenberg. Here again with Rick Battenberg, Chief Investment Officer of Clientele Capital. Website again is Clientele, C-L-I-I-N-T-E-L. See the play with words? ClientelleCapital.com. And when they go to the website, how they can go ahead and reach out, how can listeners or potential companies that are listening to the program, how can they go ahead and best way to go and contact you, or what they should learn about when they go to the website?
So, you know, we're a family business, make no mistake. You know, it's myself and my father and Monica Pina does investor relations. And then we have some smart analysts. We got some smart people working for us. But at the end of the day, you know, we believe in people, plain and simple. You know, I will bet on the person before I bet on the deal. And that is because the deal constantly changes, especially in emerging markets where the environment's changing. You want to bet on a person that's emotionally connected to the success or failure of the business. You want to bet on somebody who really understands their numbers. And I will always bet on those people because they'll find a way, you know, they'll find a way to be successful versus, you know, you can have a shiny business plan, but at the end of the day, you got to bet on the people. And myself and my father, we are people. So we're always looking for the courageous and the bold. So
Rick, this is a great conversation. Really enjoy having you on the show, and let's definitely keep in touch. And you know, let's keep us posted on any new announcements and things like that. Let's go ahead and, you know, we'll stay connected. And hopefully, people will get to catch you at Benzinga, the Cannabis Capital Conference.
I'll be there with bells on. I'm excited. I love Miami. Too much fun there.
All right. Thank you, listeners, for listening for another Blunt Business. Really appreciate all you listening. I hope you got a whole lot of this program. Come back next week. We'll talk to you next time.
The opinions expressed on this CannabisRadio.com program are those of the guests and hosts and do not necessarily reflect those of the staff and management of CannabisRadio.com. Any rebroadcast, republication, or retransmission of this program without proper consent is prohibited.
At KFC, everyday value meets big flavor. That means getting six crispy pieces of delicious dark meat drums and thighs, plus four biscuits, all for just $10 with our Dine and Dash deal. All that juicy, original recipe chicken for only $10 every day. Now that's finger-licking good. Hurry into KFC and taste the deal we're cooking up. Limited time only. Prices and participation may vary. While supplies last, tax, tip, and fees extra. Not available on third-party ordering platforms.